And as I said a moment ago, we remind ourselves of the setting of where Jacob has come down from. And when we read this passage a few moments ago, I wonder what your thought was, what your initial view was. Bit of a strange passage. With some passages, there seems to be a very clear storyline or a clear theme or very clear characters. But when we read this passage, what went through your mind? Did the questions cross your minds? Well, who is this about? Is this about Rachel or Benjamin or Jacob or Reuben or Isaac? In many ways, this passage, I guess, is a stepping stone as we step back from before answering that question. A stepping stone or a bridge which is taking us on from the past 24 chapters onto the next section of Genesis from 36 and 37 on. And in the previous long section beginning in Genesis 12, and I don't know how many times we've recapped and gone back to look at God's promises to Abraham in Genesis 12 in the first three verses there. So since chapter 12, the story has followed the characters of Abraham and then on to Isaac and on to Jacob. And we've looked at various details of their lives. We've looked at how God has worked through them and with them. And although it is about those characters, it's important to remind ourselves, I guess, that in fact, as we looked at those characters, the main character throughout that story or those stories is in fact God. So the story is not so much about those three men, but it's actually about God and about his plans, his promises, and his intentions. And if there's one big picture, one single lesson for us to learn, as we've seen throughout the series, it is that God is faithful, isn't he? He's faithful to what he said. He's faithful to his promises. He's not faithful to us. He's faithful to what he says and his promises. And that is in spite of the sinfulness and the failings of mankind and of those characters. And that's an encouragement to us, I trust, as we look at ourselves. So in the next section, which this bridge will take us onto later on, and we're not looking at tonight, we'll be moving away from the era of Isaac. We've moved away from Abraham already. We've now going to see the death of Isaac. So we'll move away from Isaac's era and his generation, as it were. And although Jacob will remain alive for some years, in fact, until the end of Genesis, the focus will now move from Jacob onto his sons, onto his 12 sons. And more particularly, as you'll see from chapter 37 onwards, onto the character of Joseph. So before we move on to that, we're not there yet, we're now in 35, the writer clearly has some things which he wants to tell us. We have to ask the question, although we might find these verses difficult, and I certainly have found them difficult, to try and figure out what actually is going on and so what. They must be here for a reason. And if we took them out, then we would be missing something in the story, in the picture that God is trying to give us. So it seems like the writer here has got some last important details, I guess, to put into place. Now, thinking of an illustration example here, and I know there's someone here who's very keen on Lego, and I was thinking of Lego. We probably all played with Lego in our youth. Some of us still play with it, not in our youth, etc. Or you might think of building a house or building a model, and there are all sorts of bits and pieces which need to be put into place. Let's take building a house. There are different parts of the house, aren't there? We need to see the foundations going in, and then we see the ground floor going in, and then we need to see that being complete before the windows get put in and before the next story, the next floor or story comes in, etc. And that's key. And I think that's what's happening here, is that the writer here is tying up some loose ends and finishing off some bits and pieces and laying some foundations before moving on to the next part of the story. So in a sense, it's a bit of an in-the-middle passage here. We're wrapping up the past series, tying up some bits, and about to move on into the next. It's my job to do this nasty bit in the middle here tonight. Now, as we look at this passage, I think we'll see that there are really three accounts in the passage. And we'll go through those and try and look at them. And each of them seems to be actually tinged with a bit of sadness or tragedy. In many ways, each of these seems unrelated to the other. And as you read them, I know I found as I first read them, you tend to feel that they're incomplete, they're stunted, there's bits missing, aren't there? I mean, where's the rest of the story? And what am I to make of this? So again, let's remember that we've been following the character of Jacob in the preceding chapters, and although Jacob is still central here, I think he is also the central character across these three stories. There are three incidents which do happen to him here. Each of these accounts would have had quite a marked effect on Jacob, I think. They would have been personal setbacks for him, wouldn't they? Firstly, the death of his wife. Okay, he had two, but this is the death of his wife he had loved most. Secondly, the deception and theft and the sin of his eldest son against him quite directly. And then thirdly, the death of his father, Isaac, who was, by the stage in Jacob's mind, a great figure. Yes, Jacob had deceived him, and it may have been quite difficult for Jacob to come back to his father and to seek repentance and to be reconciled. But nonetheless, it is the death of his father, who I'm sure he loved greatly. So let's look at each of those events and how they fit in, and then I think step back and see what the big picture is. So the first event we come to really is from 16 to verse 20, the birth of Benjamin and the death of Rachel. Now Jacob is probably about 105 years old at this stage, so he's no spring chicken, and neither is Rachel. You may remember that Rachel's first son, Joseph, had been born nearly 15 years ago, back in Genesis chapter 30. To Joseph was Rachel's first son, but she was actually Joseph's son number 11. So maybe nothing special to Joseph, but in fact he was a special son to Jacob. Now at the time when Joseph was born, if you turn back to Genesis 30 and verse 22, and you'll no doubt remember that great saga which we read of how the first 11 children were born, and how Leah had children and Rachel had children, and they were named in claim and counterclaim, and the awful details of that. But if you look at chapter 30 and verse 22 to 24, we read of the birth of Rachel's first son, Joseph. Verse 22, "Then God remembered Rachel, and he listened to her, and he opened her womb. He gave her children, a gift from God. And she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. And she said, 'God has taken away my disgrace.' And she named him Joseph. And she said, 'May the Lord add to me another son.'" So at that time, she gave thanks for her first son. And we know that she was desperate to have children. And there were already 10 children by Leah and the concubines. And she prays for another son, that God would give her another son. So now, as they, back in 35, as they are traveling down from Bethel, here we are, Rachel is expecting, and we don't know what stage this was. She was in her labor, she was quite old, and she goes into labor. And we're told it is a difficult labor. She's not so young, and that may have contributed to the difficulty of the childbirth. We don't know that. But at any rate, she's having difficulty and is clearly losing her life and dying at that stage. And her midwife encourages her with the news that she is about to have another son, the son that she so much wanted and she prayed for. Here is her second son. But even that is not enough for her to pull through, it seems, and to fight through and stay alive. And she dies. It's all too much for her. And as she dies, she names her son Benoni, which means son of sorrow. Which is quite fitting from her point of view. Jacob, interestingly, renames him, giving him the name Benjamin, meaning son of my right hand, indicating a favored position. Interesting to note, I'm not quite sure the implications really, but this is actually the first of the sons that Jacob had any part in naming. All the previous sons had been named by Rachel and Leah in their claim and counterclaim, and here we have the first time Jacob actually stepping in, and maybe for the sake of Benjamin, realizing that having the name Benoni going forward in his life, son of sorrow, might not be a very helpful thing, so he renames him son of my right hand, a favor. So Rachel dies and is buried, and we read that Jacob set up a pillar over her as a memorial in memory of her, to remind himself and others who passed that way of her and of her role in their family. Now, we're not told much more than that, are we? But it is clear, I guess no doubt, that for Jacob this would have been a time of great sadness, but also great joy. You know, obviously sadness at the loss of Rachel, who was his first love, and he had loved Rachel from when he first met her, hadn't he? And he'd worked 7 years for her, And then he had to work 7 more years for her, because Laban had cheated him and given him Leah instead. But we do know later on, if you turn forward to Genesis 48, this is later on, obviously, in Jacob's life. In Genesis 48 and verse 7. So this is a time when Jacob was old and nearing his time of death. But he's talking to Joseph and recounting some of the events of the history. And in verse 7, he reminds himself and he reminds Joseph, verse 7, "As I was returning from Paddan Aram, to my sorrow, Rachel died in the land of Canaan while we were still on the way, a distance from Ephrath. So I buried her there." So Jacob himself later on recalls many years back, and he looks back at that time as being a time of difficulty and a time of sadness, and how with sorrow he looked back to the loss of Rachel. But also sadness at the time of joy for him at the birth of Rachel's second son, his 12th son, in Benjamin. And we can look back and see that Jacob would have been able to have given testimony to God's goodness in keeping his word and his promises, in fulfilling the promises that he had made to Abraham and Isaac, hadn't he? In making them fruitful, and that they would be the fathers of a great nation. And here he is now with 12 sons, and here is the 12th being born, evidence of God's goodness to him. We'll come back and look at that in a moment. The second incident we move into, again with that first one, there's not much more we're told. In the second one, we come on to the incident of, I guess, Reuben's rebellion or Reuben's sin. It's covered in verse 22, so I guess there's almost a whole verse covering it. And again, we've got to find there's not an awful lot in there. It seems to come out the blue. It doesn't seem to be related to the previous incident or related to the next one. So in verse 22, after the death of Rachel, we read that Israel moved on again, and he pitched his tent beyond Migdal Eder. So he's continuing to move down from Bethel as he had intended to. And he now stops on the way, bearing in mind he's got a great company of people he's traveling with, so they can't travel that far. And he stops somewhere in the region of Jerusalem before continuing on. And while Israel, Jacob, was living in that region, Reuben went in and slept with his father's concubine, Bilhah, and Israel heard of it. Well, what do you make of that? This verse doesn't tell us very much at all, does it, about why it happened? So why is it mentioned at all? Why did Reuben do this? What was the outcome? Well, let's try and piece together some things we do know, and some of it is slightly speculative, so we need to be careful that we don't jump to conclusions. We do know, however, that Reuben was Jacob's firstborn son, and he would therefore have had the prominent role in the family, wouldn't he? In the ongoing succession, he would have had the birthright, by nature of being the firstborn. And he would have had the largest share of his father's inheritance. So again, if we go back to Genesis chapter 29 and verse 31 and 32, we read the accounts of Jacob's children being born. So here we have Genesis chapter 39 verse 31, the first of Jacob's children. "Now when the Lord saw that Leah was not loved, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. So Leah became pregnant and gave birth to a son. She named him Reuben, for she said, 'It is because the Lord has seen my misery. Surely my husband will love me now.'" So Reuben is born, the firstborn of many. We also know that Bilhah was previously one of Laban's servants, and she was given to Rachel to be a servant by Laban at the time when Jacob married Rachel. Now later, when Rachel saw, later in chapter 30, when Rachel saw that Leah had 4 sons and she still had no sons, Rachel gives Bilhah to Jacob to be his concubine, so that through Bilhah, Rachel could give Jacob children. So in chapter 29, verse 29, we see Laban gave his servant Bilhah to his daughter Rachel as a maidservant. And then moving on to chapter 30, verses 1 and 2, when Rachel saw that she was not bearing Jacob any children, she became jealous of her sister, and so she said to Jacob, "Give me children or I'll die." And Jacob became angry and said to her, "Am I in the place of God, who has kept you from having children?" And then she, Rachel, said, "Well, here is Bilhah, my maidservant. Sleep with her so that she can bear children for me, and that through her I too can build a family." So Reuben is the first, and we see that Bilhah is now becomes one of Jacob's concubines, and indeed he has two children through her. So why did Reuben do this? Well, we're not told explicitly, which makes the mention of it here all the more strange. It seems unlikely that it was motivated by love or lust, since, and the commentators tend to agree with this, since Bilhah would by this stage have been quite old. No offense to the aged, no doubt. But the commentators agree on this, and there also doesn't appear to be a great moral story, since there isn't a story built around this here, in terms of this is what happened and here's the outcome, and hence a big moral story. But it is just possible that it was motivated by power, a desire for power and position on Reuben's part, a desire to ensure his position as the firstborn and his prominence and his inheritance. Strange, you might see. Picture the scene. So here's Reuben. He's the oldest of the 12, 11 brothers, looking forward to his birthright at some stage and the inheritance that would be his. But also here's Reuben, who's son of Jacob the deceiver. Jacob, who had cheated his brother, Reuben's uncle, Esau, from his birthright. Reuben would have known the family history for sure. And is it not just possible that he might be sat there thinking, someone might come and take this away from me too? One of my brothers might come and cheat me, and I might lose out on my birthright. So is there anything he can do to secure his position and prominence? Well, there is a similar incident which lends some credibility to that thought in the Old Testament in 1 Kings. If you turn forward to 1 Kings, chapter 2. Page 237 in the church Bibles. A similar story we have here, which may help us to understand the motivation. I say may, I don't want to put too much weight on it, but I think it might at least give some kind of view as to why this happened here. We have in 1 Kings chapter 1 and in chapter 2 the situation where David is nearing the end of his life and his reign as king. And although he has not yet died, in chapter 1 we see that Adonijah makes a claim to the kingdom and to be king, and he sets himself up as king. Bathsheba goes to David and warns him of this and reminds him that he had promised that Solomon would be king. So David then proclaims Solomon as king, which obviously is a problem for Adonijah. So Solomon becomes king, and Adonijah is deposed, as it were, from his unrightful kingship. And in 1 Kings chapter 2, in verse 22, we now have Solomon as king. And in chapter 2, Adonijah now comes to Bathsheba and says, "Will you please ask," verse 17, "please ask King Solomon, and he will not refuse you, to give me Abishag the Shunammite as my wife." Now, Abishag had been David's concubine. So here we have a pretender to the throne, Adonijah, asking for Abishag, who was David's concubine. Now, it's interesting to note that Solomon's response to this, we see in verse 22, "Then King Solomon answered his mother, 'Why do you request Abishag the Shunammite for Adonijah? You might as well request the kingdom for him. After all, he's my older brother. Yes, for him.'" Solomon regards this as not just asking for a favor, but asking for the kingdom as a stake to the kingdom. He sees this as Adonijah undermining Solomon's rightful kingship and kingdom, and so seriously does he see it that he actually puts Adonijah to death. So the parallel could be there, that is this Reuben trying to stake claim to his father's inheritance, although it's his by right, and going and taking his father's concubine in the same way that Adonijah did? Well, we don't know that. We're not told that for sure. But whatever the motive, this clearly was an awful act. And we're not told if Jacob acted any way at this time on that. We do know that he knew about it. Verse 22 tells us that he knew. He heard of it. But the outcome is clear. So verse 22 tells us that Jacob heard of Reuben's sin. And we also know that that sinful act, possibly the very act that Reuben thought would give him inheritance, That act actually in the end meant that Reuben lost his prominent role. Now that's the key. Turn forward to Genesis 49. So again, Genesis 49, we're right at the end of Jacob's life. And many years later from the time when this incident happened, when Joseph had already been sold and gone down to Egypt. This is after the famine and after Jacob and all the family had moved down to Egypt. And Jacob knows that he's nearing the end of his life and he's about to die. So he calls his 12 sons to him, gathers them round his bed. He's about to die and he's going to give them his fatherly blessing. And we see in chapter 48, verse 21, then Israel, Jacob said to Joseph, I'm about to die, but God will be with you to take you back to the land of your fathers. And to you, as one who's over your brothers, I give the ridge of the land I took from the Amorites with my sword. Then we go on, and Jacob blesses his sons. Then Jacob called for his sons, and he said, gather round, so I can tell you what will happen to you in the days to come. And he then goes on in the next chapter to actually address each of the 12 sons in turn. And it's quite a theatrical, dramatic occurrence. You can imagine them gathered round the bed there. And Jacob, this great figure, his great age, sits up and he now addresses them and gives his blessing. So the first to come in verses 3 to 4. In verse 2 he says, assemble and listen, sons of Jacob. Listen to your father, Israel. Reuben, first up. So Reuben pays attention. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, the first sign of my strength, excelling in honor, excelling in power. Sounds great. Things are going well. Verse 4. But turbulent as waters, you will no longer excel, for you went up onto your father's bed, onto my couch, and defiled it. So here we have the effect or the outcome, and Reuben is denied his birthright and his prominent role because of his sin with Bilhah, because he took what was Jacob's. Interesting to note again that we go on to verses 5 and 7, when Jacob now addresses Simon, Simeon and Levi, who were the second and third in line in prominence. And they also are cursed. Simeon and Levi are brothers. Their swords are weapons of violence. Let me not enter their council. Let me not join their assembly, for they have killed men in their anger and hamstrung oxen as they are pleased. Cursed be their anger, so fierce, and their fury so cruel. I will scatter them in Jacob and disperse them in Israel. And again, that refers back to the time we saw when in Shechem, just two Sundays ago, we saw evidence of their violence and their actions. So they too are denied a prominent place in the history and among those tribes going forward. And guess what? Guess who's fourth? Well, the picture comes into play now. The fourth son was Judah, fourth in line. And we won't go into it now, but later on in verses 8 to 12, Jacob blesses him and clearly takes a different line with Judah than he had with Reuben, Simeon and Levi. So Judah now takes the leading position in taking the line of promise forward on to David, and as we know, on through to the line of Jesus, descendant of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob and Judah. And we see that clearly in Matthew chapter 1 when the genealogy of Christ is listed, isn't it? And it lists all those names: Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Judah through David, etc. So here we have the case here. We don't know why Reuben did this. We can speculate, and we're not given exact reasons, but what we do know is that he sure acted like father, like son, but this fits in here because this is the time in the chronological order when this happened. This sets the scene for later on when Jacob would then take the birthright away from Reuben, take away his prominent role. And it was a loss not just to Reuben, but also to the tribe of Reuben going forward, because there are not many leaders, or any leaders, I don't think, from the tribe of Reuben going forward. So we have Reuben's disobedience has forfeited for him the blessing which should have been his, God's blessing for him and his descendants going forward. Another strange incident there. The third incident we come to is, I guess, the return of Jacob back down to the land of where his father Isaac and Abraham had lived, and bringing his 12 sons with him. And this now prepares us to move on from looking at Isaac and Jacob to the next phase of Joseph and his other 11 brothers and the 12 tribes. In these verses here in 23 and 24, 25 and verse 26, you'll see now list the names of the 12 sons of Jacob. But in this case, they're listed here in family groups, as it were, not by age. So they're listed by group of mother. So first of all, the sons of Leah, then the sons of Rachel, and then the sons of Rachel's maidservant Bilhah, and then lastly, the two sons of Leah's maidservant Zilpah. And we have to go back to Genesis 29 and 30 to see the actual age order or chronological order of those sons, the order in which they were born. So these verses, as well as listing these sons, now bring us back and bring Jacob back to the land where Abraham had lived. We see from verse 27 onwards, and Isaac lived, and they also go on to cover the death of Isaac. So Jacob finally returns after this long journey coming down from Paddan Aram, and through these incidents, the death of his wife and the sin of his son Reuben, he now comes down to the land where Abraham and Isaac lived, and he brings with him his 12 sons, and he can come to his father Isaac and present his 12 sons, Isaac's grandsons, his 12 grandsons, and present them as evidence of God fulfilling his promises to them both. Finally, I wonder what that would have been like for Isaac. It must have been quite a moment. Look back to Genesis chapter 26. On page 19, or page 20, Genesis 26 and verses 3 to 5. And this is in verse 2, Genesis 26, verse 2, the Lord appeared to Isaac. So we go back some time and remind ourselves of what happened here. And he appeared to Isaac and said, "Do not go down to Egypt. Live in the land where I tell you to live, and stay in this land for a while, and I will be with you and I will bless you. For to you and your descendants I will give all these lands, and will confirm the oath I swore to your father Abraham. I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky, and will give them all these lands, and through your offspring all nations on earth will be blessed, because Abraham obeyed me and kept my requirements, my commands, my decrees, and my laws." So we see the same promise we'd seen back in Genesis chapter 12, 1 and 3, made to Abraham. Again, God now reiterates it and confirms it for Isaac. And he says to him, "I will bless you and your descendants, and I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky, and through your offspring all nations on earth will be blessed." And moving on to chapter 28, verse 13, page 22, Genesis 28 and verse 13. Again, we find the same thing. So this time now God is talking to Jacob. So just as he had promised to Abraham, just as he had promised to Isaac, he is now speaking to Jacob. And in verse 13, there above it, the stairs that he saw, stood the Lord. And he said, "I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. I will give you and your descendants the land on which you are lying. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. All peoples on earth will be blessed through you and your offspring." So again, the same promise was given to Abraham, to Isaac, and then to Jacob. And now we have, at the end of this chapter 35, we have Jacob coming down, and for the first time he can come back to Isaac, and he can present the evidence of God's promises. Sure, they're not as numerous as the sands of the sea yet, but here is the first evidence. He has come back to the land where he should be, and here are the 12 sons, which later will become the 12 tribes. So why is this here, this listing of names? Is it just another dull piece of genealogy that we come to love and know so well? Well, at this point, the writer, who's probably Moses, wants to, I guess, remind us of the progression of those promises and to prepare us to move on to the next stage. So just as the illustration of a building and laying foundations in first floor and second floor, so here he wants to complete the ground floor of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And now here are the 12 sons before we move on to the next series, the next big epic in the rest of Genesis. And this would also become key family history for the people of Israel, wouldn't it? from this point on. So in future years, they'd be able to read this, to understand this, and through this, they would see how they had come to be a nation. They could look back. And it's through passages like this, the same passages that we read, they would read about Abraham and about Isaac and about Jacob. How they came to become 12 tribes. Where did they come from? And here we have it in all the detail. They could look back and they could see this, but not just this, but they could see how God, who called himself their God, how God had worked through their faulty and failing forefathers to achieve his purposes, as we can. It is only through these accounts that they could look back and see God's grace to them as he'd worked through these people. So again, this is the evidence of God's grace to Jacob, not just the gift of sons. And he could return to Isaac and say, look what God has done. Not what I have done, what my wives has done. Look what God has done. And that's a change in Jacob's heart. We saw him fighting for himself early on, didn't we? We saw his wives fighting for their own sons and producing their own sons. But now we have Jacob coming back saying, no, look what God has done in spite of my striving. He has kept his promises to us all. So finally we come to the death of Isaac, and again, we're not told very much about that. But no doubt it would have been a very sad time for the family. Not much details here. The way Isaac's death is described here gives one the sense that he was ready to die, if that is ever possible. We sometimes use the phrase, oh, he was ready for death, he died a good death. But we read here in verse 28, Isaac lived 180 years. Well, I think I'd be ready to die at that stage. That's probably two or three times the age of the oldest of us here. But verse 29 says, he breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people, old and full of years. You don't get the sense that he was reluctant to die or was vigorous. He was old, he was ready, he was aged. Isaac knew and trusted God, and he was gathered to his people, gathered to his God, old and full of years. So here we have these three mini stories, these three accounts, these events, all of personal setback and sadness to some degree for Jacob. And a reminder, I guess, that obedience to God, which Jacob had begun to learn, it doesn't remove these setbacks from our lives, does it? We're not protected from these. But that through these events, Jacob had and he learnt and he gained a greater understanding of God, and he developed a greater trust in God. And through these, we can see God's perspective in our lives as well, can't we? Through difficult times, like he could. That he gives us the grace and the strength to continue through difficult times. We're not told very much about Jacob's reaction to this whole chapter. We've read a bit about his reaction to Rachel. We can probably understand from these verses that he didn't give up. We see in verse 19 20 and 21, after the death of Rachel, in verse 21, he moved on again. He didn't give up. He carried on his journey down south to where God had told him to go. And then again, after the setback with Reuben, and he heard of it again, we see in 27 he has moved on and he comes back down to his father. So he's progressed. He's continued his journey south. And verse 27 again tells us he's moved all the way down to where he should be. But we can look back with Jacob, as he does later on in his life, and we can see something of his deepened relationship with God later in his life, and how he had come to view God and trust God. And we have to turn again forward to towards the end of Genesis chapter 48, when Jacob looks back at his life. And again, this is many, many years later, and this is the time when he's just before blessing his 12 sons, he is blessing Joseph's sons. Chapter 48, verses 15 and 16. And we read in verse 15, then he, that is Jacob, blessed Joseph, and he said, may the God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life to this day, the angel who has delivered me from all harm, may he bless these boys. He was referring to Joseph's sons there. But you see the tone that Jacob takes. He has moved from perhaps viewing God as the God of Abraham, or maybe the God of just Abraham and Isaac, to seeing that God is, yes, Abraham's God and Isaac's God, but he's also my God, Jacob's God. It is God who has guided and sustained him all his life. He calls God his shepherd. And we look forward again, I guess, to the Psalms and David's Psalm, the Lord is my shepherd, the shepherd who takes care of him, the God who has been my shepherd all my life to this day. So he recognizes, even in the times when he had not recognized and given God the credit that God was due, when he was rebelling against God, he could look back and see, in spite of my rebellion, God was still my shepherd through those times. He was my shepherd. The angel, God's angel, who has delivered me from all harm. So he can look back at that and acknowledge God's goodness to him. Well, back to chapter 35. It brings us to the end of Isaac's era then. But it's not the end of the story, is it? I think that's one of the key things we take away here. This is not the end of the story. We've seen great stories of Abraham and the promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And we come to the end of the life of Isaac and the end of that era. But it's not the end of the whole story. God's plan and story is not yet complete. He is still working it out. And he's continuing to unfold it and work out his plan as he has been since Genesis 12. He has started it. God started it. And God will continue to unfold it over the next few chapters and on through the next hundreds of years, through the tribes, through Judah, and on through the birth of Jesus. That's God's time frame, not ours. And as we look with the writer at the end of this era and look back at how God has worked through and with Jacob, and aren't you surprised or amazed that God didn't just give up on Jacob? What kind of character was he? Surely God could have chosen someone maybe a bit more cooperative, a bit more helpful, a bit more obedient, a bit more holy, a bit more upright. Well, thank God he didn't. Because if that were how God worked, then none of us would have a chance, would we? If we're honest with ourselves and with God, then like Jacob, we're also too prone to be focused on our own desires, our own plans, our own agendas, our own short time scales, our own life, doing things our own way. We're far too focused on these things. And the perspective on our lives and our time and my future, they're all too self-centered. And that's the impact of sin, isn't it? Jacob learnt that, and later on he could say, the Lord has guided me through all those times. And he could see the promises to his grandfather and his father and to himself. And he could look forward with faith, as we see in Hebrews, to what would come later on. So he'd learned to take a different perspective. So the wonderful truth we find from Genesis and from this passage, as this key bridge point here, is that God had a plan, and that he chose to include Jacob in that plan. Why didn't he give up on Jacob? Was it because Jacob was, well, a bit of a rogue, but actually not that bad? No. Nothing to do with Jacob, but everything to do with God. God persisted with Jacob because he's a God of grace and a God of mercy. And he didn't give up on Jacob. And he didn't give up on Jacob. And he didn't give up on Jacob. And if you've trusted in him, then he won't give up on you either. If you're a Christian here tonight, then just as with Jacob, God has a plan and a purpose for you and for me. He has started a work in your life. He started it. And he will complete it. His plan for you is to present you holy and blameless. But we know as we look at ourselves that we could never stand before God holy and blameless. I know I couldn't. On my own, how can I stand before a God who is holy and righteous without being consumed by his wrath and his fire? We cannot present ourselves holy, but it is Jesus who will perfect us. Look at Colossians chapter 1, verse 21, New Testament. Page 832, Colossians chapter 1 and verse 21. And Paul writes to these New Testament Christians, and he reminds them, he says, once you were alienated, like you and I. We were alienated from God, and were enemies in your minds because of your evil behavior. But now he has reconciled you by Christ's physical body through death to present you holy in his sight, without blemish and free from accusation.